Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Beyer. Let's get growing. Welcome to the show. I'm so excited to introduce my guests today, Althea Vasilis and Aaron Staub, who come to us from Long Island, New York, my home background, and they have the Orchestai farm there. And I'm going to let them take it from there. Go ahead and introduce yourself, ladies.
Hi, my name is Althea Vasilis.
And I'm Aaron Staub.
And we run Orchestai Farm, which is a nonprofit organization and ecological farm. We grow lots of vegetables and a really beautiful community. We work with individuals on the autistic spectrum and on the autism spectrum and the with other developmental challenges.
Excellent. So I guess we'll just kind of take turns. And, you know, I always start out the show by asking people to tell us about your very first gardening experience. You know, like, how old were you? Were you a kid or an adult? Or who were you with? What'd you grow? How big was it? So, Althea, did you want to go first?
Sure.
Okay.
I started gardening with my father when I was maybe, 5 years old. I used to be paid a penny a weed to weed the garden, but I could only get paid if I counted all of the weeds. So as many as I counted, I would get that many pennies, which was not that nice. But I was very motivated because maybe I counted up to 100 or something and I got $1. anyway, this is a financial boon in my 5-year-old mind. But I really liked being in the garden with my father because it brought more than that. His favorite crop is dandelion, and I've been eating them since I was also probably 3. And so I just have all these memories planting dandelion upon dandelion.
You eat like the dandelion leaves, right? You don't actually eat the flowers, do you?
Okay. No. Well, you can eat the flowers, but I eat leaves. Actually, the plant he planted is actually in the chicory family. It's Italian dandelion, so it's not actually like the wild.
You're in the yard.
Yeah, exactly. But we now I eat the flowers too. They're quite beautiful in a salad.
Now, where did you grow up? Did you grow up on Long Island?
I grew up on Long Island, yes, and on Long Island, my father had many friends because he's a big talker, and so from this little garden at my grandfather's house, he asked all of his friends if he could plant seeds in their backyards. So we would go from house to house. Most of them said yes. So we would go from house to house planting vegetables and taking care of them and visiting all of our neighbors. So it was like a little farm, but all over the place.
That's awesome. That's excellent.
Yeah, it was a unique childhood in that way.
Did you have brothers and sisters that would go along with you too? Or?
Well, my brothers kind of resisted more than I did. So Daddy's little girl. I was the main worker. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. All right, Aaron, you're up.
Well, I did not grow up on Long Island. I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana. I had a couple, small gardening experiences with my grandmother. She definitely kept a garden the whole time that I was growing up. But my first real farming or gardening experience came a couple years ago, I guess about 5 years ago. I decided I really wanted to know more about farming. And so I actually participated in the woofing program and went and farmed in northern New Mexico in the mountains up there with this amazing old hippie couple who had kind of a homestead up there. And I stayed with them for a season. And learned most of what I know about farming until I met Alethea. And then she taught me the rest of what I know.
Okay, so does one of you want to answer the next question about what does organic gardening or earth-friendly mean to you, or do you both want to, however you guys want to do it?
Sure, I can start, and Erin can follow me if she has anything to add. Having dabbled in both permaculture and biodynamic, I think organic farming is a good start, but something that can evolve into an even more complicated system of ecology and ecological inclusivity. We are, you know, even though, you know, we're not doing, a lot of organic farmers aren't doing monocropping, I think it's important to keep in mind also that just when you till the soil, it helps fertility immediately, but in the long run, you're killing a lot of the soil system that really helps to keep the land healthy. So I would say that on our farm, although we're not certified organic, I think we don't really use any kind of chemicals at all. Sometimes to the detriment of our brassicas, especially, who are infested with aphids this last year. But we really are, it's a long-term process, so we're trying to build the soil through adding to it and not tilling it. We don't have any heavy equipment. We're only on 1 acre. So for us, trying to mimic what you find in nature is the closest thing we can get to keeping our farm most ecological and not, less keeping the damage to the environment down. So we're trying to be inclusive of especially lots of communities of microorganisms and bacteria and protozoa and nematodes, all of the science of the soil that's so amazing that can be built up through adding to it, like with mulches and green manures and stuff like that, instead of tilling it constantly. So that's I think what that means for us.
Yeah, that's a great answer.
That said, we're in the beginning of exploring this, so we don't, we only have a couple of years under our belt with this method and are by no means experts, but are trying and experimenting and have had success with it thus far.
Well, good. And I think that's a big part of gardening is, trial and error and what works,
right,
and talking to other people and learning from them. And so that's part of the mission of my podcast is to just,
right,
share people's different stories and journeys.
Definitely.
So, Erin, do you want to answer the who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques question then?
For me personally, it was what I was first drawn to. It just made the most sense for me. I think both of us kind of come from a place, whether it's farming or people or anything in life, that we try to approach it as holistically as possible. So I think it just made sense to me. But Alethea has been farming this way with her father forever and ever, so it was kind of ingrained from a young age.
Yeah, and he runs a certified organic farm, so... We call him up with lots of questions,
yeah,
all the time.
And we know we would have someone very upset with us if we were to do anything other than holistic, ecological, organic farming.
All right. Well, maybe he'll be a guest on the show one of these days.
Yeah. He would be a fantastic,
excellent,
guest.
He's quite the character, so I warn you.
Oh, right. You said he's a talker. Excellent.
Yeah. You would get a good ab workout from his jokes. You'd be laughing so hard.
All right, I could use it, believe me.
Yes.
No worries. That's funny. Because most people are like, you have no sense of humor. So that would be totally if you can make me laugh. All right. Well, I'm going to ask both of you. So, well, Althea, I guess you learned how to garden organically from your dad then. So then, Aaron, how did you learn from working with the
Sure.
hippies
I learned from the hippies.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm totally a hippie, 100%.
That's
Nice.
definitely how I learned. I mean, I worked on a biodynamic farm. So, again, it was kind of beyond organic. There were a lot of just very mindful ways of going about farming and gardening, and it was very kind of subsistence oriented rather than market or money oriented. So I really that's where I felt I fit into the farming world, and I appreciated that perspective.
So let's go a little deeper with that and tell us a little more about the subsistence, oriented type of growing a garden. Like, did you see big differences there? Like, what were some of the things that you noticed that were a little bit different than looking at it from a profit type of perspective?
Well, I mean, I guess size is definitely a factor, which, for us right now, we had, we're on an acre, and it's, there's always someone telling you, oh, like, are you going to get bigger? Are you going to get bigger? And it's kind of nice to be small, I think, for a lot of reasons. And I think a lot of people have come to that realization that bigger is not always better.
And you can grow a lot of food on an acre.
Yeah, definitely. We grow a lot of food. And these farmers that I learned from also grew a lot of food. They definitely, provided for neighbors and things like that. They basically just had a very small amount of everything. They had organic vegetables and fruit, but then they also had a couple goats and would milk, have milk from the goats, and so they kind of had a little bit of everything that they needed, and it was you could care for it in a different way, than you would if you were always mindful of like a bottom line or a profit. So I don't know, I appreciated that place to learn.
Okay. Well, let's talk about this last season, last year. Tell us about something that grew really well last year for you guys.
What grew really well? Well, we had huge escargot.
We did.
Which was so yummy.
Yes, and didn't require a ton of work. We didn't do much to the escargot. We also grew an amazing heirloom zucchini called Costata Romanesco, which was like an Italian heirloom. That was the most delicious zucchini, and also we didn't do much to it, and it thrived this year.
Yeah, it was beautiful, and the tastiest zucchini
Yeah, it kind of tasted like butter.
ever. Ooh. Well, now, where'd you get those seeds? Do you remember, or do you know,
I think,
John?
yeah, we got thanks to high mowing and Hudson Valley Seed Library, we got a donation last year of, oh, well, 25 pack of seeds from Hudson Valley and 100 from high mowing, and we were incidentally introduced to this variety by their providing us with the seed, and it's kind of like a prehistoric zucchini. They can get huge, and even when they're big, you don't even have to use them for muffins because they're so tender and so sweet. Without, they can be harvested at any size. So we have those two seed companies to
Yeah,
thank
for
for
sure.
their generous donation. Yeah. It kind
Okay.
of looks like a dinosaur zucchini.
It does. Okay.
Yeah.
And why, maybe just really quickly for maybe some listeners, do you want to tell them what escarole is? I mean, my mom used escarole all the time, so I know, but some people might not be that familiar with what it is.
Sure. Well, it's escarole is a green, and it is often used in Italian cooking. It looks kind of like lettuce, but it's bigger and thicker. The leaves are like thicker. It's not like as paper thin as a lettuce. So often people at the farmer's market will think it's a lettuce, but it's not. Although you can use it raw in a salad, or often, you know, you can cook it with white beans and garlic or something. It's really yummy.
Okay. And then is there something you're excited to try next year, or do different next year that you're going to try?
We were just talking about that. I think we're really excited about growing more heirlooms in general. We grow a lot of heirloom tomatoes we're just constantly astounded by the taste and heartiness and the everything of most heirlooms that we've grown. So we're excited about kind of looking that way a little bit.
Another term. Do you want to just tell the listeners exactly what an heirloom vegetable is compared to maybe just a regular vegetable?
Sure. Well, if people have seen at the farmer's market, and I don't know what the markets are like up there, but I'll just give you a visual example first. Like an heirloom tomato is one of those like craggy, you know, cavernous maybe and mountainous tomatoes. They're not perfectly round. They have a lot of variation and are often sweeter. But it's like a, you know, it's a heritage variety. So it hasn't been really crossbred,
right?
Or modified. You know, often a lot of our seed, I mean, everything's been modified just by naturally, but a lot of our, you know, more round tomatoes or varieties that are more uniform have been modified in laboratories. They're just, seed places that are choosing for more uniformity or resistance to certain diseases, et cetera. But these are seeds that have been cultivated and maintained by, isolated communities over years. They really taste much better.
And it's important we keep those seeds going. So
absolutely.
That was a good definition. I like that.
Yeah, good.
All right, tell us about something that didn't work so well last season.
Well, I have a couple things in mind. We tried Hansai Thai, which is an Asian green. Mm-hmm. The only reason I think it didn't work well was because we didn't water enough. Our mulching system, we actually don't have to irrigate as much as other farms say they irrigate. And because the mulch that we use holds in a lot of moisture in the soil, and it's increasing organic matter, which holds in the moisture even better. it's a cover and prevents evaporation, but it's... You know, I think we didn't water it enough, so I don't know that it wouldn't work again if we didn't put in our drip irrigation this year, if we put it in. What other things didn't work well? You know, peppers, this year we had so much virus in our peppers that they kind of get...
they're perfectly fine to the green stage, but beyond green, once they start turning those amazing, beautiful colors that you want them to be, they start getting some, you know, a virus and get little spots and various things. So we just harvested all of ours as green peppers, which was perfectly fine.
That works.
Everyone enjoyed it.
Yes, it was great.
Yeah.
How about something that you find is easy to grow and generally successful every time in your climate?
Oh my gosh. Well, we grow a perennial, which I don't know if I would recommend it unless you don't mind it spreading all over the place. It's called Jerusalem artichoke or sunchoke.
Oh, and interesting.
It is such a big producer, but it produces these tubers that are kind of like cross between a potato and a water chestnut, and they have a very earthy taste and produce a lot of gas in people's intestines. They're really good, and they grow really well and proliferate really well. So there's really almost no labor needed around it. Let's see, other things that grow well in our climate. They also produce really beautiful flowers. So, you know, you can have a good flower crop too.
Yeah, definitely. Our tomatoes are generally great every year. They've been wonderful. Cross your knock on wood. I'm jinxing myself. But eggplant as well has been really great.
Mm-hmm. Got any tips for growing eggplants? Because sometimes they can be kind of challenging.
Yeah.
I think we've just been lucky.
Let me think.
Well, it's funny. The year before last, you know, without much effort on our part, we had an amazing crop of eggplant. And then this past year, we put the seedlings in as transplants, and they got massacred by flea beetles very early on. And they managed to come out of that, but they, you know, they were a little behind. So I don't know, from year to year, it's definitely different every year. And you know, we'll see what happens this year, but.
All right, I'm going to ask some more questions here then. So tell me about your acre. Like, do you have raised beds? Do you just have like long beds in the ground? Like, what's kind of give me like a visual of what it looks like there, maybe more?
Yeah, sure. There are long beds in the ground that are about 3.5 feet wide and about 144 feet long, and there is a middle path going up the farm. In between the rows, we also have the same amount of space, about 3.5-4 feet, because we're not practicing as intensively as we could, because a lot of our student farmers, you know, find the bigger spaces to be more accommodating to their needs. You know, so we're definitely thinking about the people in our ecosystem as much as we are, you know, production, which is a big part of the reason we do what we do. Even more so than the farming, I would say.
Do you want to explain that a little more, or talk about that a little more, about how that all fits together?
Sure. Well, our mission statement says we exist to promote the creative participation in society of those differently abled through ecological agriculture and the expressive arts. And how this came to be was that I was working with a young woman, giving her direct support. She's on the spectrum, and we formed a relationship, and I was working as her support person, taking her to university and studying with her, and she types to communicate, and she typed to me one day, "Alethea, I want to go to the farm, to your father's farm with you. I would really like to try it out. I think it might be what I want to do for the rest of my life." And so she said, "Of course we can go. That would actually be really fun to do that together." So we went, and that day she planted hundreds and hundreds of tomatoes with my father and I. You know, and she has her own way of moving and dancing, and you know, she's nonverbal, so we communicate in ways other than using verbal words. We, you know, we can type, or there's a lot of Not, yeah, she doesn't do sign, but it's more like gesture, well, you know, like your a body language, I guess you would say. You know, so we learned how to work together, and over the next couple of months, she came a couple more times to my dad's farm, and her mom came back to me saying, "I think we should buy some land. We want to be farmers." And I said, wait, you've had all of 3 days to experience. I mean, I've been doing this for 10 years. I don't know if you
What you're
know
getting
what you're
into.
getting into, you know, because it is very hard work. And it's, even though it's amazing work, it is very hard work. So I encourage them to look to go to the local state park to ask for an acre of land, to try a pilot project to see if they could do it on their own and see if they would like to continue after that. So they did, and surprisingly, the state park gave them a piece of land, and they
I'm
ran a
very surprised, but
yeah, we were too.
I you know here I was, what, I was like 25 suggesting this, and I was idealistic, and but I said, why don't you have nothing to lose? You could just ask. So I think I was just as surprised, though, that the state park was so open to it. And they had a farm there for 3 years, and Erin and
Oh
I
my gosh.
managed it in its third year. And finally, their farm, called Sustainability Farm, just bought land upstate like last week. And they're living out their dream of creating a farmstead residence for people, for you know, a few people with autism. And so I'm very proud of them. And they passed on their acre to us, and that's the acre we're on now. You know, so the way we plan our farm, I guess, you know, the layout. Although we could get more out of an acre, we are trying to be inclusive of you know people who might you know might be running across the field at times, or you know have their own rhythm and dance and may not realize that they might be dancing in the bed, or you know. So we try to allow enough space for everybody's movement and be inclusive in that space. So for us, the green pathways in between our rows are just as important as what we're growing.
That's a great story. I didn't realize you guys are at the planting fields. I guess Michelle told me that, but I just didn't, I probably forgot. I love the planting field. My family has gone there so many times. I have so many memories. It's one of my favorite places. You know, that's the thing. A lot of people who haven't been to Long Island will never understand how many incredible green nature walks and natural places have been preserved. How many sanctuaries there are, and just different. My parents were so good about taking us to everywhere to explore.
That's
And so.
wonderful. I know. I grew up going to the planting fields again since I was very little. You know, my family always flocked to the green spaces you're talking about. It's really quite unique.
Well, cool. And so the and so okay, so that started it, and so then that's where you are. You've just taken that over there. Oh, cool.
Yeah,
Okay,
so we've
excellent.
taken that over, and we've, you know, because we knew the community well, we, you know, the woman we were working for asked us if we'd like to continue because she couldn't do two projects. It was too much. And we said, absolutely. In fact, we were hoping she would ask
Oh,
us.
nice. Well, good. Oh, I'm so glad it all worked out. And I think, you know, there's so many great things for listeners to take away from there, that, you know, it started with an idea that maybe some people would have just right away poo-pooed and said, oh, the state's never going to give you any land and they're never going to do that. And just, you know, using your, maybe you can call it naivety, but just your belief that, yeah, give it a try. And then that worked. And then they tried it for a couple of years, you know, just because they were passionate about it and it was something that they wanted to learn and to give it a try. You know, they weren't like, oh, well, you're not, you're, you know, you're kind of being negative saying we shouldn't do it, so we're going to give it up. Instead, you know, grab. How about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
Did you hear my pineapple story?
No. Did you tell us a pineapple story?
That must have been when we got cut off. My response to that was pineapple, just because last year on our opening day, we had, you know, garlic, leeks, and onions popping out of the ground in May. And we went around the farm asking people to try to identify what these various things were coming out of the ground. And one of the responses, very adamantly, was, that must be pineapple. We were so shocked. So we're not growing any pineapples. That would all be very difficult.
What was it that was growing that they thought was a pineapple?
I think it was leeks.
Yeah.
Oh, uh-huh.
I don't see the resemblance, but hey, I mean, maybe when it's little, it looks like, you know, the little spiky leaves of the pineapple. Maybe. I don't know.
Does a pineapple grow on a tree? Am I
wrong? No, actually, it grows on the ground. I just realized this. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, it's like a.
It kind of looks like it's like growing in an agave plant or something, right in the middle. Yeah.
I guess I probably have never seen a pineapple growing in Canada. Yeah, we don't know about it.
They would also be hard to grow in Montana.
Yes. Yes.
Yep.
But after that, I've said a more realistic answer would be celery. I think we would love to grow celery, but it's a little difficult. It's very water intensive. We try not to rely too much on a lot of water. And I don't know.
Yeah. Also, I mean, Brussels sprouts aren't hard to grow except for when you don't use any kind of insecticide or anything, even the organic ones like us. So, you know, we get a lot of aphids sometimes, which we're hoping by building the soil and building the communities in the soil over time will be remedied. But that's been a little bit challenging for us. Some of the aphid infestations in the brassicas.
Aphids are tough.
Yeah.
They are many.
All right. How about your least favorite activity to do in the garden?
Oh yeah.
Anything you gotta?
I think we're both itching to answer. I was gonna say for us specifically, because our farm has these big grassy paths in between each of our rows, we have to mow the whole acre, and it takes forever. So not that that's a specific gardening activity, but for us, it's a necessary.
I've had that answer. That's like the third time somebody said.
So it's
it's a design question, I guess, when you're designing your garden. How do you want to design it? And obviously, for us, it's important to have those spaces. But for someone else, it might be not as important, or they might put other things there, or you know, have access to more to wood chips or something to put in the middle of the road.
What were you gonna say?
I was gonna say. By the time August comes around, I don't like anything. And in January, I love everything. But that's just to say that it's like a, you know, it's a love-hate relationship. It's definitely a, you know, it's definitely, a miracle, you know, you're participating in small miracles. Well, maybe huge miracles every day. But at the same time, you know, the human input side can be a lot.
I love that answer. Very honest. And I can totally relate.
Yeah.
I think the funny thing is, I was telling Mike the other day, my husband, I was like, it's interesting that people keep saying they don't like to mow, because that's like one of the few chores I like to do. Now, granted, he mows a lot more of our yard than I do, because I don't have the time as much as he does. But our yard is so big, we really need a riding lawn mower. I don't know how he mows it by hand when he does, because sometimes there was one year where we ran the riding lawnmower was broke or something, and he had to use the push mower, and like days, and just by the time he was done with one end, the other end was time to start. But although that's one of my favorite chores to do.
Yeah. This is a good time though to listen to books on tape.
Yeah.
I finished
a few years ago.
Yeah. I finished Anna Karenina in like 5 days because I was weeding and mowing for like 14 hours a day.
All right. Well, that might get old. That would be a lot of mowing. But that is a good point that it's a great way to listen to audiobooks now with Audible and everything out there.
Although you don't want it to detract from observing what's going on in your garden too. So I would recommend a good balance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's only so much, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I gotta stay distracted in the garden.
Alethea changed my world last year when halfway through the year she put on her headphones to mow, and I was like, what are you listening to? And she was like, oh, I've got like a whole book going. And I was like, oh my God, I never thought about that. It's a brilliant idea. So it changed my mowing for sure.
Cool. So how about your favorite activity to do in the garden?
It doesn't directly relate to the gardening aspects, but I really like... My favorite thing is when I see two of my student farmers connect on the farm. And to me, that's like my world is always blown apart. You know, people who, you know, may struggle with communication or being around others who can come together in a, you know, in a safe environment and come, you know, grow closer. It's like, to me, that's the most exciting things. You know, cultivating vegetables together does for me.
Yeah.
It really brings people together.
Definitely. We've had some really great community events as well. Some, you know, kind of workshops on the farm where we invite people to do things that they might not normally do, like sit in a field and just listen to what's going on or feel the wind and things like that. We try to really bring the various arts and onto the farm in lots of ways, but those have been some really very cool experiences too.
So you're going to expand and reach out to the schools?
Yeah, we have a couple of farmers coming from school districts, more this year than last. You know, they are able to come to the farm because they need workplace experience. So, you know, besides the farm being a therapeutic place, it's also like a pre-vocational place. And it has a lot of, it's also recreational. There's a lot of meanings that can be felt in it. But the schools so far, there's a couple of school districts that are very interested in partnering with us.
Excellent.
So that's exciting. Good deal.
I think that'll grow too.
I think that's an avenue.
And you both sound like very, you know, approachable, teachable type of people. So I could see you expanding that way.
Yeah. Well, we try, you know, it might be part of our personalities too. But we love people. So we try to have as honest and meaningful communication as possible.
All right. Althea, how about a favorite tool that you like to use? Like if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
Her hori-hori.
My hori-hori. it's like a Japanese spade / knife / serrated edge / has like a little ruler on the back. But it has a wooden handle and it's pointy at the end, and it serves so many functions. So it's, yeah, it comes from Japan and it's called Hori Hori. I love it. And a friend of mine also gave me this long grub hoe. It's like this long, well-handled Italian hoe almost. And I like to go. I like that because it has so many memories. My friend Jeff has spent a lot of time working with me on my dad's farm. So again, it's the memories that are surrounding the tool as well.
Cool. How about you, Erin?
I'm also quite a fan of the Hori Hori. Alethea introduced me to it, and it really is quite a fantastic tool. But I also really enjoy, probably because it's the most fun tool I've ever used, the broad fork. Because I feel like it's like riding a pogo stick, but you're also not, you know, disturbing the soil all that much. You're kind of just aerating ever so slightly. So I feel like it's kind of a delicate but large and effective tool to use.
A broad fork. So tell me a little more about a description for that.
Sure. It's kind of like... I mean, it's called a fork, so it is kind of fork-like. Two big handles on either side with a metal bar at the bottom, almost as if you took a rake and made it completely flat. So it has a couple of tines that go down, and you basically put it into the ground, hold both handles on each side, and kind of rock it back and forth. So it kind of just loosens and aerates the soil a little bit. And then you kind of move it down the row.
But the handles are like 3 feet apart sometimes.
Right. So you kind of stand on it as if you were on some sort of pogo stick or something. Yeah, it's a fun tool.
It's good for harvesting carrots.
Yeah, good for harvesting carrots. Sure.
Okay. So how about tips for eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time? Like, so we were introduced through my sister-in-law goes to your CSA. So you guys are definitely harvesting a lot of vegetables for a lot of people. But, you know, that's always been one of my challenges. So how do you guys deal with that?
Harvesting on time?
Yeah, so it doesn't go bad. For me, it's... I don't know. It's always tough. Like, I'm lucky if I pick it one day, wash it the next day, and eat it the third day.
Yeah. Well, I guess the CSA model is really great for that because you're not shipping or distributing or whatever, you know, across long distances or many days. You know, people come and just get their vegetables the day that it was picked, which is great.
Having a schedule. Do they know when they're coming?
Yeah.
Like a set schedule that they go to?
Yeah. So CSA pickup is on Friday from 12:30 to 3:30. Oh. So all of our CSA members come during that time. So Friday morning is our big harvest. And, you know, from week to week, we just observe the plants and see what we think could use another week to grow, what we can harvest now. Sometimes, you know, the planning goes awry and we have to give way too many greens. Although for me, they wouldn't be way too many because I love to eat them. And so what really it helps that people know exactly when they're coming. And so we know exactly when we're going to harvest. Also, the farmers market we supply is the very next day. Okay. So all the harvesting is occurring pretty much once a week. So it's easy, you know, we've really tried to keep things simple this year and not juggle too many different harvests because we have so many aspects of this business and nonprofit that need tending to. Yeah.
And you don't have a hard time with like vegetable, like everything getting ready before that or like something, I mean, only harvesting once a week is enough, huh?
Yeah, we definitely harvest certain things throughout the week and kind of, you know, just keep them refrigerated throughout that time.
Some things.
But
it really
small.
depends.
It's a small amount. You know, when we have an influx of like peas or something, you know, or zucchini that are just, you know, showing up every single day, there's a new zucchini, you know, to be
things
harvested.
Like that we'll have to store.
But only for a day or two, usually.
Yeah, or some really ripe tomatoes. You know, and obviously you can't do the whole harvest on a Friday morning and be done by 12:30
right.
at certain points during the year.
So do some like Thursday afternoon or Thursday morning? Probably don't harvest much in the afternoons, right?
Yeah, it's more mornings.
Yeah.
Although our farm doesn't have any electricity, so we don't have any refrigerator storage there, and we're really bare bones at this point. You know, so we have to really think about it. Actually, sometimes we do harvest in the afternoon right before we go home. So that's, you know, that's not preferred, but it does happen because of the refrigerator is located 15 minutes away and we can't leave when our students are on the field. So, it's a juggling act.
All right. How about secrets for like preserving food or making it last? Like, do any of your CSA customers say, you know, what can I do to make this last longer, or how am I going to keep this?
Okay, I'm going to tell you a really interesting story, and I use interesting in the least committed version of the word. One of our CSA members often preserves the food we give them, and just this past fall, our CSA was over, and I went to his house. He and his wife have this lovely little baby who we call Farm Baby. She comes to the farm and charms everyone on Fridays. But they are, you know, they're hunting and they have a garden of their own, and they're very they kind of have a homestead lifestyle in that way, and they'll preserve our food. But the thing they offered me in the fall was a pickled deer tongue with our carrots and onions and garlic. I unfortunately couldn't bring myself to eat it. but he had a really interesting recipe. I could contact him if you're interested. but my husband and I do some fermentation, lacto fermentation of some cabbages, and we made a nice kimchi last year, really good.
Dehydrate a lot of tomatoes.
Oh yeah, that's probably the best. We have a small dehydrator, and we even the heirloom tomatoes, we cut them up into pretty thick pieces and dehydrate them, put a little herb de Provence on top, and then store them in olive oil, and they basically taste like really gourmet tomato fruit roll-ups in olive oil. It's really, so we have them all.
I might have to try those next winter.
Yeah,
that's,
we have them
all
winter. Yeah. Yeah, when you're at, you know, you have a, no tomato tastes good because it's the middle of the winter and they're all coming from afar when they've been picked green and they're not organic. Oh, these are really like saving grace.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. I'm almost scared to ask this question. So do you have any special techniques for cooking weird or unusual foods?
After the deer tongue comment.
Right?
Weird or unusual food. It's funny because I think what we think is, you know, what we don't.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah. Things we don't consider weird and unusual, other people often consider weird and unusual.
Well, like land seaweed. We grew land seaweed this year, and I wouldn't recommend it unless you're going to eat it right away.
Yeah.
Because it gets spiky.
It's a cousin of the tumbleweed. So it does turn into a tumbleweed type plant after the first or second harvest. But we did want to try out some new and interesting things. So we grew land seaweed. It's actually quite delicious. It's a bit like a succulent and it's salty.
We put it in a salad when it was still tender and it was excellent.
Yeah, it was very good. Trying to think what else.
You know, with anything before, if I don't know what it is but I know it's edible and my farmer told me it's not poisonous and all that stuff, and I want to try it, I usually just taste things raw to see what its character is. And then from there, I don't know, the way my mind works, in my culinary mind works, is that I can place the taste and decide whether I want to cook it or not. And the texture, you know, goes by texture and taste and smell and all of that. So a lot of things I just end up eating raw. But if you want me to make a really weird comment, I can. my dad, something interesting. My dad had this idea. Now this will be the deciding factor whether you want to interview him or not. he decided that there should be restaurants that are better than raw food vegan restaurants. They're healthier. In fact, they would be called live restaurants, and all you would have to come to the restaurant and eat the food from the vine in its natural state by getting down on your hands and knees and nibbling it off. You know, so excellent. That could be a good way to try new vegetables. we believe in, you know, making oneself uncomfortable a bit to have new experience because life is too short.
Definitely.
That's funny. I was just listening to an interview about, have you read that book, The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss?
Oh.
And
yeah,
he's got this challenge in there where you have to go lay in the middle of a crowded place like a mall or a shopping store or something and just lay down on the ground and just be totally uncomfortable and like just get outside of your comfort zone. And they're like, you know, people are going to look at you like you're weird and you're going to feel totally out of place. But I mean, you only have to do it for like, I think 40 seconds or 60 seconds or something, like just a minute. But just they say that will really push you outside of your comfort zone.
Yeah, well,
I could do that a lot easier than I could eat vegetables off the vine in public with just my mouth, especially.
In secret this year, you should just go up to a tomato and take a nibble. See how it feels.
Okay. In my own garden, I could probably do that.
Yeah.
Just the bees watching and my dog.
Yeah, exactly. Private.
Okay, how about a favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden?
We do very simple things, I think, with our vegetables. You know,
you can say a salad.
What comes to mind is just
heirloom tomatoes. Oh. With what?
I'm actually picked with olive oil and salt, but it has to be really good olive oil too. And maybe a little bit of a tiny dab of balsamic vinegar. It's really just so simple. I can't encourage people enough to think simply.
Heirloom zucchini, I was talking about, you know, cut it up, put it in a pan, a tiny bit of olive oil, a tiny bit of salt, and I don't even know if you need the salt. It's like, it's amazing. So, we do things pretty simply, I think.
Mm-hmm.
How about a favorite internet resource?
We were trying to think.
Yeah, I don't know that there's anywhere on the internet that we really reference frequently. I know both of us find books and people who are writing about farming and soil biology and things like that we go to.
Yeah, I think the best thing about being a farmer is drawing on other farmers directly. And I know during the season, I definitely try to, I don't have time to look at the internet as much. And I have more access to local people who are also growing food. And I think that's probably the most appropriate resource for, you know, if someone's growing food right down the road and you can compare notes. for someone who's in your zone and climate. And I think that's really invaluable. So maybe the internet resource would be like the white pages or something. Yeah. You know, get the phone number of your local farmer and ask them lots of questions.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I was just curious because since you have a nonprofit and a business, what about do you have like an internet resource that you use for your business at all, or like a software program or something that helps you, or where you found like information on starting a nonprofit or keeping it going or anything like that?
Sure. Well, I mean, the nonprofit world, there's so many different aspects. So, you know, as in any farm or any business on nonprofit, et cetera, you have to think about finances. And I know it's a hot topic in the organic farm world too, how to make your farm profitable. But it's also how to make your nonprofit profitable and, or even just steadily like compliant with the rules and regulations, et cetera, because there's a lot to keep up with. So we've found, you know, resources to help form a nonprofit. I would go to the Foundation Center website. They have a lot of online tutorials about, you know, how to incorporate, how to form your bylaws, how to deal with your board, etc., how to fundraise. Yeah, so I guess we've been more internet oriented around the business. The nonprofit aspects of what we're doing.
Yeah, we definitely got an education in nonprofit management. Luckily, we're in New York City, so we had the luxury of being able to go to the Foundation Center for. They have a ton of free classes and little workshops on the basics of nonprofit startups and management. So that was really amazing.
Really amazing, yeah.
Be able to have access to. But they also make it available online in libraries, I think, across the country. So that's a great resource.
Yeah. I guess the other thing I'll say is, you know, for farming resources, like when you're ordering seeds or you're like those seed catalogs, and there a lot of them are online, they have so much information. And, you know, you can read the descriptions of the different vegetables and they give you so many growing specifications and stuff. It's, if you spend enough time on you know, seed websites, you could learn a lot, actually.
Mm-hmm. That's a great answer. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. So how about as far as business advice for listeners, like if they wanted to start a farm or something or get started in the industry, you know, open a CSA or something, do you have like any advice for how to start that?
Yeah.
Like how'd you guys get your very first customer for your CSA?
Yeah, well, because we're in the state park, we participated in their Arbor Day Festival. And so we've set up a booth and we were talking to people about what a CSA is and how it works logistically, et cetera. Cause I think a lot of people do have questions and don't know still what CSAs are. So if there is some sort of farming conference or Arbor Day Festival or, you know, state park gathering or some, you know, anything related that you can go set up a booth with some visuals and explain to people directly, I think that would be really a big help. You know, putting a face to this, to a business is always helpful too, just in the human aspect of it.
Yeah. And we found that the more connections you make, you know, you talk to one person about a CSA and they say, oh, you know, that's how we found you. Right. You know, the value of community and relationships that you make is important. We've found that for sure.
Yeah. Also getting yourself into a green market or a farmer's market, you know, the first time I ran a CSA was at my father's farm and he had an abundance of stored root storage crops for the winter that he didn't know what he was going to do with. and instead of sell them wholesale to local supermarkets, which, you know, you usually don't get as good a price, I said, well, why don't you have a winter CSA? And so all of his customers from the farmers market really loved his produce, and he was able to, a lot of them wanted to sign up, and he had a waiting list to participate. So that's also another public venue that you could, you know, get your face out there, get yourself out there if you're a startup farmer. You know, and I know some of these farmers markets are hard to apply to. Well, at least in New York City, it's like a 50-page application.
You're kidding.
Yeah, it's you know, there's so much. There's like the Union Square Market. There's a lot of vendors already, and it's, you know, they have to be more selective. So it's very exciting on the one hand, and it could prove to be more difficult in a big city to get yourself known, you know, as a good competitor in the business. It's a lot of connection, though, a lot of groundwork. And, you know, that's also, it's a challenge. And, you know, to some extent, you have to be comfortable with talking with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so here's my final question. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? Like, is there a charity or an organization you're passionate about, or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or like on a global scale? And I hope you're both going to answer. Like, Althea, are you going to go first? Or
sure. I mean, I have several different answers to that. One is, the first is, I think everybody should be mulching.
Everybody mulch.
But, you know, that's just, you know, I'm also open to that not being practical sometimes on large scale farms, because it is more labor intensive in the beginning. But for me, really, really at the heart of almost every issue on our planet is emotional awareness within oneself and in one's relationships. And I really believe in doing personal work, which then affects every aspect of your life and your relationships. Because if we're talking about ecology or farming, or even what we're doing, you know, relationships with our farmers, and, you know, the relationships, it's all about relationships. So, you know, if you have one aspect of your system that is suffering, whether it's suffering because it doesn't have the proper nutrients, or they're not able to be released in the soil, or it's suffering because, you know, it's had a trauma, or it's had a difficult time in life in this certain aspect, you know, the whole system will be affected. So I guess more so than having anything directly, you know, participating in the environmental movement, which I think people should do, of course, and the farming movement, etc. I think everybody should do their own internal work and try to have the best relationships that they can, which might mean, you know, looking into themselves. So that I think is at the core of everything.
Very nice. Okay, Erin, you're up.
How can I follow that up?
Sorry.
You know, there's so much going on, and there's so many complex issues. It goes on and on. But I think I would have to kind of echo what Alethea said just about mindfulness and caring. I think it all comes down to that. And you know, if you're mindful and caring about your relationships, then you're mindful and caring about the environment and just every aspect. I think that really has a place in all aspects, and that could really change the way things are at the moment.
Yeah. And I'll add one more thing. I do think I do think in the farming movements and what I've seen in the permacultural movements, not so much the biodynamic, because the biodynamic movement has been more inwardly focused as well, you know, on emotions and spirituality. I do find people focusing on the science and the what to do, and less on observation. And although in permaculture, do a lot of observation, but more like internal observation, I would say. And you know, I've been to many conferences, and I just wish that people, you know, instead of like saying, "Oh, this person is bad because they used this chemical," or you know, there's a lot of judgmentality. And I think if we're going to work on issues in our environment, you know, we can't continue to have factions of people who, you know, who want to use Roundup, who don't want to use Roundup, and they're demonizing each other, because I think it comes down to a relationship. And if we can find some place to talk about things and relate to each other in a better way, instead of thinking so black and whitely, I think we'll be a lot better off, and things will naturally evolve. I mean, maybe I'm too idealistic, but hopefully, I would hope they would naturally evolve to a place where, you know, people would want to make the right choices for their planet. After, you know, there's so many, behind everything, I really believe there's a thickness of emotional resonance, and a lot of our arguments, I think, could be lessened if we looked at ourselves.
More cooperation and listening, and not being so like having more of an open parachute type of mind. How did that quote used to go about?
Yeah.
You want your mind to work like an open parachute. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's true. And I get so frustrated with people because, you know, it seems like I can talk politics with anyone. And even though I have super passionate, very strong beliefs, I have tons of friends who have super passionate, strong beliefs that are completely opposite than mine. But right. I think it's important that we express them, and we, absolutely, you know, acknowledge that we each have those feelings, and, you know, maybe someday we're going to change each other's minds, or maybe we're not, but we're still going to go for walks in the woods or play tennis or go skiing together and agree to, you know, when people are just like, well, I can't talk to you because, you know, you feel that way, it just kind of frustrates me. So I totally understand what you're saying, and that we just, you know, generally we're all kind of want the same goal in the long run anyway, and it's just different thoughts about how to get there, and
I suppose. Yeah, definitely.
So I like your answers very much. All right, ladies, last thing, just do you have like an inspirational tip or a quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
Why not?
Cool. I like it.
No reason why not. I just helped a friend. I visited her in Virginia. It was our little vacation week, and she, you know, her backyard is completely shaded by trees. Her front yard, she feels like, is a little, it's just not really maybe acceptable in her community yet. So we made a compromise, and she has a very sunny little strip on the side of her house. And so in an afternoon, we found some scrap wood and some tools, and we made her a little garden on the side of her house. So I just feel like, why not?
Yeah. From me, I guess it would be that, I think I would say read Teeming with Microbes, and then you'll definitely be fascinated. I think, I mean, you might be, depending on who you are, you might be grossed out, but it's, you know, talking about bacteria, some people are afraid, but it is, if you think about the soil food web, it is like, just imagine this world so much bigger than what you can actually understand. And yes, you help facilitate putting a plant in the ground, or watering it, or but there's so many miracles happening every day. It's like he just it's just inspiring to watch what unfolds, you know, and mostly on its own.
Cool. All right. How about if people want to connect with you or find your farm or come to the planting fields? Do you have a way for them to reach out to you?
Sure. They can go to our website, which is www.orchestifarm. Mm-hmm. And that's
www.orchestifarm. And I'll put the link to it in the show notes. And yeah. Anything else?
Just that orchestra means collaborative movement, and it comes from the Greek word to dance together. It's like the ancient Greek theater had a place where dancers danced together to interpret the nonverbal aspects of the play being performed. So maybe that will help you understand the name and remember the website, therefore.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being my guest, being patient, and Althea and Aaron, it was just so nice to talk to both of you. I just love what you're doing, and the next time I'm in New York, I'm definitely going to come visit the planting fields and meet you, and hopefully. And
please do. We would love to host you.
Thanks.
But we'll put you to work, so be careful.
Okay.
I'm kidding.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to visit our website at awesomemontana.com. That's just AWESOMEMONTANA.com. Like awesome Montana, all spelled out. And click on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener Podcast, and it will link right to the show notes and all the things we've talked about on today's show. If you like what you've heard today, we'd love it if you'd head over to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. It really helps us get found by other listeners and share the knowledge. Thank you again for listening, and have a great day.